Hello, and welcome to the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks with me, Mark Wade. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by RJ Wirth. He is CEO consulting psychometrician for Vector Psychometric. RJ, welcome to Lifestyle Talks.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Full disclosure, so RJ and I know each other for quite a while. We are both prisoners at CPATH, ECY Consortium. So we kind of know each other. So it's going to be a fun conversation, I think. RJ, I want to just jump in because your whole career, your whole with Vector, the whole thing is instrument creation. And that's, to me, that's very exciting and very complex and very chunky thing. So I want to talk about that if I may. And I know that I want to talk about some of the things that you've done. I know that you have developed some instruments in conjunction with for the FDA and stuff. Could you just cover that for one sec so we know where we are with us at the table?
Sure. And thank you again. Yeah, no, VPG, or Vector Psychometric Group, is a company I started back in 07. We are a measurement company, so I think that makes us sort of unique. And since that time, really before that time, my focus has been, for one reason or another, on measurement and developing measures and helping people understand measures. So I have spent my career developing, modifying, and examining various types of assessments, with a lot of it being in the health space. So that's been really, really rewarding, and I've learned a lot over the time for those years. Much of that work has really been focused on helping others with their own measures or using somebody else's measures. We have had a couple opportunities to develop our own, one of which started back in 2019. We were very lucky to be awarded a clinical outcome, a core clinical outcome endpoint and outcome assessment. I forget the name of the grant exactly, but it's a granting mechanism from FDA that was intended to develop a core set of endpoints and their associated measures. And as I said, we were fortunate enough to be awarded one of those grants in 2019 and then spent the next 5 or so years doing something we often don't get a chance to do in this industry, which was take our time to develop new measures. And that was, we were able to work very closely with FDA, but really just the real benefit of that project has been able to run multiple qualitative studies, run a really large in-depth quantitative study, and we feel like sort of do it right and work through the process in a more reasonable pace than we have in the past. So that's been a wonderful experience. And now we have the MECOA's measures. It's 11 different measures for migraine. They're intended for use in migraine trials, and those are ours to do what we want with them. But hopefully what we'll do is just let other people do a lot with them.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. So those COAs, I mean, do you license them out to other sponsors?
Those, the ones that we like. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, no, we license them to sponsors. Anybody is welcome to use them. In fact, I think everyone involved in the MECOA's project would be a little disheartened if people didn't use them. We did spend a lot of time, effort, and energy to develop what we think are sort of gold standard approaches to develop a gold standard measure or set of measures. So yeah, they're out there for pharma companies or others, researchers, academics to use.
And I was going to academia as well. Okay. So this brings into an area that I think is like the dark arts of instrument creation. And that's the licensing piece. And the challenge we have, and you said to me a while ago, I thought it was an interesting phrase. You said like instruments are living, breathing things. They're not static. And to someone like me, that's fine. But then we have to have proper verge control. We need the instrument creators to actually have a methodology and an SOP around verge controlling. And in my experience, sometimes that's not true. What's been your experience of trying to maintain the verge controlling and maintaining licensing?
No, that's a really good question. It is, I think it is, you know, the administrative aspects around scale development and holding and licensing and modifications are, you know, is probably more difficult than the actual psychometrics to develop a measure. So, you know, as we were talking, you know, previously, I do really see measures as a living thing. I think this is true really in any high stakes environment. You know, they didn't write the SATs 20 years ago and haven't updated them since, right? It's sort of a constant churn in education more so than in health outcomes. But the way that people interact with the world, the way that people read and understand items, the way they interpret items and interpret response options, those things change over time. And when they do, if we fail to account for that in our measurement strategy, we are essentially have people answering different items than they used to. They might be the same text on the screen or on the paper. It might be the same responses. But if people are interpreting them differently, or if people are engaging in the world in a different way, and thus are responding using a different thought process than they did 10 years ago, they are responding to a different item. And pretending that they're not leads us to assuming that these scores are comparable, assuming that we're measuring the same thing over time, and assuming that we can sort of use the knowledge that we had from 10 years ago or 20 years ago to understand the scores that we see now. And that's not necessarily true. So there has to be a constant sort of check-in to make sure that things are still behaving the way that they should be behaving. And if they're not, make some adjustments. And doing that as a psychometrician or measurement scientist is fairly straightforward. Doing that when they're being used in clinical trials and one measure might be used over large span of time and you want to make updates midway, like, that can get a little tricky. But I think it's, you just have to be very thoughtful about it and have people understand that changes aren't a bad thing. It's not just so we can update the license. It's not so people sort of, there's something new to sell. It really is to ensure that the measurement strategy is consistent. By changing it in a weird way, it makes it more consistent over time. And that's an important thing for people to understand.
And I think people are seeing the world differently in terms of like how we're absorbing. Today, we're all on our phones, on our screens. That's a very different thing than it was 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So that in itself is different. I mean, now tell me if I'm wrong here, but you were involved in a pediatric study, because you and I talked about this, a pediatric study some time ago. Am I right?
One interesting example of, you mentioned sort of the way people are interacting with the world. We helped develop a measure for Johnson Johnson Vision. This is the public domain, so I'm not sharing anything I shouldn't. Called the contact lens user experience. We developed that in, let's see, that work started in 08. So the initial development of those, it's three domains. It was created as an item bank, so there's over 300 items. Really, really extensive work. But in 08, people, when they interacted with the world and saw the world, they didn't do it staring at a screen, at least not the same way that we do now. So in 08, 09, we have plenty of items in there about reading newspapers and looking at TVs and working on a computer, but not a single question was in the original item bank asking about looking at a phone. And obviously, you fast forward, right? The iPhone was released in 07. It wasn't the first one to have internet, but it was the first one to have sort of a desktop-grade fully HTML browser, and that just revolutionized how people interacted with their phone. So fast forward, you know, 07, by the time you get to even 2011, 2012, the way people interacted with the world was very different. So asking them about how they sort of see the world and how comfortable, say, contact lenses are as they go throughout their day, not asking about a phone, is missing a mark. So these are things that are sort of seem very like minor changes, in terms of how somebody expresses their quality of vision, but it can have a real impact in terms of the content that's covered. So that's I think that's, you know, a really sort of good example of why it's important to sort of stay on top of these things. I think you mentioned the pediatrics bit, and this is sort of a flip side of the coin, where people are motivated to update a measure for what they, I assume, think is a very sort of well-intended purpose. So we develop a measure for adults, and obviously that doesn't always work in children. The same measure, we can't really ask them the same sorts of questions. The sort of the problem with sort of letting anybody sort of do what they want with these measures and not treating them as very structured, or not having them within a very structured maintenance program, is that you start running around with different versions made by different people, and there becomes a blur between sort of what is the original quality work that all the evidence that we've generated supports, and what are these one-off bits and pieces that may have the same name, but not necessarily have the same rigor behind them. And an example that we ran into a few years ago at this point, but a good colleague of ours produced a measure. It was widely used. People sort of adopted it, and that was great. And he didn't do that for a living. So he just sort of put it out there and said, take it and run with it and use it. But then he started getting emails and questions, and it started showing up in studies a pediatric version of it, which had his name on it and was associated with his development and all this, but he never touched it. It was somebody else decided to make one and just sort of said, well, I'll use the same name because I use that as the sort of guide. And it just got really blurry about, was it updated in a rigorous, consistent, thoughtful way, or is it somebody wanted a new version, so they made one, and before you know it, it sort of propagated and became its own thing, when in fact, the original author had nothing to do with it. So it's really important to update and maintain and be thoughtful, but at the same time, keep some control around it to ensure that the same level of quality and rigor is there throughout, and that you can have faith when you use a measure like McCoa's or some other measure that others have developed, that you're using something that you sort of do have. And that's challenging in this industry.
There's two things there. There's two points there. One is that there's got to be an ethical kind of guardrail that people use instruments, the latest version. But the problem is, as you rightly say, an instrument gets out in the wild, and it does get out in the wild. I know that a lot of people try and protect their intellectual property. Like, a lot of developers don't allow sample documents unless it's like watermarked with sample. And then there are unscrupulous people who remove that watermark and then use that instrument. So it's a very strange thing. But I've noticed that, I was told by a colleague who changed that, and he's in academia. He maintains that within academia, it's rife. People are just sharing instruments and they're not actually using proper version control. They're not getting licenses. They're just like, oh yeah, I want to use that instrument. And he explained to me that that is more prevalent than I know, kind of thing. Do you have the same experience with academia? I'm not finger pointing academia. I'm just saying they're very straight up and telling you what's happening to their instruments.
No, I heard you, Mark. You think they're all horrible people. You said it.
Glad you said it. I didn't want to say that.
No.
Well, thank you for coming to this podcast. It's over now.
Obviously, we're kidding. No, I mean, I think there's a different mindset, a different approach, and I think sometimes a lot of good reasons, right? So I think in the pharmaceutical industry or drug development or broadly, there is a lot of emphasis put on the evidence to support an endpoint and a measure, the sort of the quality control that went into that, having a history, right? If it's not documented, it didn't happen. Like, it's a very formal, very strict, very methodical approach to clinical trials. And more, and I think rightfully so, more and more, the measurement development and support and maintenance is being seen with the same sort of rigor and expectations. In academia, there are a lot of instances in which that is also true, where people are trying to sort of come up with a new treatment for something, a new outcome, some sort of predictive model that could have real impacts in life. And the level of rigor and the confidence they need in these individual measures that are used really varies depending on what they're doing. So when there's less need for that, the same level of confidence in the measure, I can see people being a little freer with it. The challenge, I think, as measurement developers is really understand in some cases they don't care about some of the rigor, not for any wrong purposes. It's just it may not be central to their study. It may not be central to what they're doing. And it's really just more of a questionnaire to get some little info on the side, as opposed to in pharmaceutical trial. But if it's the same measure being used, unfortunately, we sort of need to put the same sort of rigor and the same licensing and the same restrictions on it, because being really, really strict in one area and then letting it just go flow free in another area, there's no way that they're not going to cross-pollinate and end up with things sort of making their way back over from academia into pharma. So I get why it's freer, and I understand that there's a different goal a lot of times to measurement in academic circles, and that is what it is. And I think it's just really important for licensing to keep an eye on that.
In your experience, and again, another thorny issue, but in your experience, have you seen an instrument being used that is not the latest version, or the translation? I know you don't see translations, but have you seen a translation being used that is not the latest version, yet the study has already started with that out-of-date instrument? Have you ever seen that happen?
Quite often, measures are used that are sort of out of date. And again, I think It depends on how the measures were structured, and it depends on what type of support that they offer. I do think it happens. I think it happens quite a bit, not just in pharma, but across disciplines. People sort of take whatever they used last time, they'll just sort of carry it forward and use it this time and the next time. And version one is five, who needs version 10, right? Like version one is fine. Now, if it's a very rigorous measurement program with sort of upkeep and sort of thoughtful developers that are maintaining something, you would hope that if for one reason or another, say a company wanted to hold on to version one and use it throughout a series of studies that are all sort of for the same indication, that the test developers, as they're updating these measures, there's some backwards compatibility. So even if they are using version one, as long as you know what version they're using, you have some ability to understand how that is different from the current version and what impacts that. So you can still be sort of thoughtful about the interpretation of it. I think where it gets hard is when there's updates that are made, I'm sure very thoughtfully, but aren't made in a way that allows it backwards compatibility in this. We just decide we're going to add new items or drop an item, but we're still just going to sum score it up and throw the total score out there. Those total scores are no longer comparable without a lot of work and effort. So it can be really problematic in a lot of areas because you start comparing apples to oranges. In some areas, if you have a thoughtful measurement program, you need to know, but these are all things that we can adjust for and handle in a thoughtful way.
There's one thing we got to touch on, and that's the elephant in the room, okay? We got to touch on this, whether we like to or not, and I hope we have time, is how AI is changing the landscape of instrument development and instrument licensing. To put it in context, there are unscrewed people who can get an instrument, put it through an AI engine, create something very, very similar, and then it's going to be used. Where do you land on this? And moreover, what do you see as a huge threat to copyright developers, to instrument developers?
Yeah, that's probably a better conversation off screen with age requirements, but we'll try to have it here. I mean, AI is, you know, obviously really interesting, and it can do and offer a lot of opportunities to streamline and sort of take away some of the work that's involved. But I think it has the worst name in the world because it's not intelligent. So I think having systems that are out there readily available that could potentially take one measure and sort of make a derivative of it, but in a way that people don't see it as a derivative, is bad, not just for measurement development, but publishers and book authors and what have you. I think there's a lot of stuff out there already that talks about the rate of plagiarism and hallucinations and all these other things that could be really problematic, especially if we're working, you know, or consider a self-scientist, and having those sorts of issues creep up has to be sort of should sort of sound alarm bells to people when they hear those things. In terms of measurement development, you know, I am sure there are ways that AI will make the development easier and quicker in some ways. I do think we have to be extremely cautious to ensure that we're not just using an overly aggressive software product to rip somebody else off and basically take a lot of somebody else's hard work and have it spit out in a new font and call it our own. So I think there's a lot of great opportunities for it, but it makes me really nervous for science in general because you really do lose sort of the ability to track where things are coming from. You lose the ability to replicate. You lose, well, maybe you don't lose. It makes it much more challenging, I should say. So
I think you're.
I'm all in favor of AI. I just think we have to be super cautious with it.
Yeah, I think people who do those sort of things—that's bad science. We shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't be allowed to do those sort of things. Anyway, I digress. I'm going to leave you with, this is something that I ask all my guests. Maybe you've seen it on the other podcasts, but I always say, if you had a magic wand, if you had one wish, right? If you had one wish for anything in instrument development, instrument creation, instrument licensing scenario, what would that wish be?
That AI did it all. No, I'm just kidding. No, that's a good obviously. Question. I think, just leave it to AI. It's fine. I think it is probably, if I could wave a magic wand, it would really focus more on just sort of education and understanding around measurement science, psychometrics, validity theory. And these are all things that are extremely important when you're developing and licensing measures to understand, about this sort of backwards compatibility. Right? There's a lot of science that goes into developing and maintaining measures. So I think that isn't surprising to anyone. And it's not surprising to anyone, at least not surprising to me, that a lot of people in this industry don't have that background because that's not what they do, right? They're bench scientists or chemists. There's all kinds of people in this industry that understand measurement enough to understand that it's what they need and understand that they need it for an endpoint and understand that we need evidence to sort of get things deemed fit for purpose. But we often are working with different language, like a term I use means something different to somebody who's not in my area, and sort of bringing people along and getting a more common language and a more common understanding of the core principles that underlie measurement and validity, I think would make this process a little easier. Even when it comes to licensing and versioning, I think if you have a broader understanding of how some of these more advanced measurement models work and what it means to have or be able to say something that is valid, I think it would make the whole process a little smoother. I'm fortunate enough to be working on something similar. It's not a magic wand by any means, but it's another FDA-funded project. And that project is really developing a core set of training materials around the PFDD guidance series that will be made available. It's for FDA. This is funded by FDA, but it's for their internal use, for stakeholders, for sponsors, and for patient advocates and other stakeholders. So it's a whole training series that we're putting together that's eventually going to be available online and available to stakeholders to use, which will hopefully sort of give everybody this at least sort of common framework to operate from and allow us a little to have hopefully more informed conversations around PFDD guidance and just science otherwise. So it's not a magic wand, but it's as close as we can get.
No. I wish I'd asked that question before, because that is so germane. RJ, you're just going to have to come back. You're going to have to come back and we're going to talk about PFDD because it keeps coming up. But you saved the best till last. I could kill you. Thank you so much.
It's a cliffhanger. We'll talk again next week.
I know. Yeah. Then see the next episode. Thanks, RJ. Today I was talking to RJ Wirth. He is CEO, consulting psychometrician at Vector Psychometric Group. RJ, thank you so much for joining me today. If you would like to come on the podcast yourself, click on the link below. Either you've got some research that you want published, or you want to talk about something that you feel is under noticed, recognized, or maybe you just want to talk what grinds your gears, what pees you off. Click on the link below and join me in the next LifeSite Talks with Mark Wade. Thanks a lot, RJ. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.